Today is Thursday, September 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, the top 10 Democrat Party presidential hopefuls square off on the debate stage tonight. We have a preview. Plus, Russian authorities launched a wave of police raids early Thursday, targeting supporters of opposition leader Alexei Navalny.
The timing of this raid seems highly political. It's coming right after Navalny backed a smart voting strategy.
And a program in the Philippines aimed at tackling a plastic problem. Those stories and more are next. There were once 20 hopefuls on the stage, and now there are just 10 candidates making the cut to square off on tonight's Democrat Party presidential debate in Houston, Texas, on the ABC television network. Joining us live on the phone is VOA national correspondent Jim Malone. Jim, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Steve.
So, Jim, what can we expect tonight in this third debate of the candidates?
It's the first time that the top contenders will all be on the same stage at the same time. And let's look at the layers of the contenders. At the top ranks, you have former Vice President Joe Biden. You have Elizabeth Warren, the senator from Massachusetts, and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. They occupy the top slots. Biden has been leading. That's been a constant dynamic in the race, though his totals seem to come up and down. But the real dynamic on display of late has been the rise of Elizabeth Warren into either second place or at least a tie with Bernie Sanders for second. Then you have seven other contenders at various levels of support. Many of them are just going to be struggling to make a statement, make an appearance, and hang on into the race.
You speak about the other seven who are trying to make a statement or just, you know, trying to be seen. Is this for them maybe a pitch to try and become the VP nominee after tonight?
Well, I don't think a lot of them are thinking that way yet. I mean, I think it's strictly in terms of trying to get their candidacies to survive. It's interesting that the people who qualified for this debate tonight also automatically have qualified for the next debate in October. But if some of these folks do not do well tonight, some of the lesser candidates, and their fundraising drops off over in the weeks to come and they don't get as many opportunities to make their case, who knows, some of them could be faced with dropping out of the race. And we've already seen a number of folks drop by the wayside in recent weeks.
Right, and we talk about the polling numbers. I mean, yes, Biden, Sanders, Warren, and even Harris are at the top of the echelon there. But you have folks like Andrew Yang and Pete Buttigieg who still are pulling so far down. How much longer can they really stay in a competitive race, you know, with the next debate coming, you know, a month away?
I'm sure their strategy is to try to do well tonight and then hang in so you can make your case in the next debate in October. The question is, after that, will the Democratic Party, make the qualifications tougher to qualify for future debates in November and December? And that's going to be an issue for them. The polling requirement at the moment is only 2%, but you have to do it in four polls. And we know that, for example, Tom Steyer, the impeachment advocate and candidate, has qualified for the October debate, but he won't be on the stage tonight. So there's still some time, but time is running out.
Jim Malone is VOA's national correspondent. Thank you so much for your insight today. We look forward to speaking with you after the debate tomorrow.
Very good.
Here are some other major stories from around the world. The U.S. House Judiciary Committee has approved a resolution that defines the parameters for conducting an impeachment probe of U.S. President Donald Trump. Thursday's procedural party line vote allows the committee's chairman to designate hearings as impeachment proceedings and allows witnesses at such hearings to testify longer than usual under committee rules. At least 10 and possibly more than 50 people were killed early Thursday when a train derailed in southeastern Democratic Republic of Congo. The railways in the DRC have a poor record for safety, hampered by poor tracks and decrepit locomotives, many of them dating from the 1960s. Airstrikes pounded the south of Syria's Idlib region on Thursday. A rebel official and resident said despite a ceasefire that has halted a fierce army offensive against the rebel stronghold 2 weeks ago, government warplanes bombed the south Idlib countryside for the first time since, including Marat al-Numan town, according to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. Russian authorities launched a wave of police raids early Thursday, targeting supporters of opposition leader Alexei Navalny and dozens of cities across Russia. Charles Maness reports for VOA. Charles, what exactly are authorities saying about why these raids took place?
Well, formerly police linked the raids to an ongoing investigation into money laundering by Navalny's Anti-Corruption Foundation, which Russians know by its Russian acronyms, FVK, FVK, as they call it here. And supporters, of course, say these moves are aimed actually at paralyzing the organization's regional infrastructure. You know, the timing of this raid seemed highly political. It's coming right after Navalny backed a smart voting strategy during recent elections. This was a tactic that essentially coordinated voter anger around candidates who were most likely to beat the pro-Kremlin opponents. And it was credited with significant losses for candidates supported by the Kremlin in Moscow's most recent city council elections here.
How many raids are we talking about?
Well, the numbers that they're giving here, they're talking about 200 locations in 41 cities Russia-wide.
That is a massive effort.
It's a mass effort. It suggests it was a highly coordinated effort. Of course, these are in cities everywhere from Kaliningrad, that's in the east, in the far west of Russia, near the Baltic states, all the way to Vladivostok in its far east. So it's a very highly coordinated effort. Interesting also to note that several of the Navalny supporters in the regions immediately had their bank accounts blocked as well.
What was the rationale for that?
Well, again, there might be, formally the investigators say this is tied to these money laundering charges. Specifically, they've said that Navalny and the Navalny Anti-Corruption Foundation, again, FVK as it's called here in Russia, had basically money laundered about $15 million in illegal funds from outside sources without providing much evidence of that so far, but the investigation is ongoing. So presumably that's what these bank account blockages are tied to.
Alexei Navalny, has he made any comments about these raids or spoken out against them?
Yeah, he's released a blog post this morning. He said, if you wanted to know what this was about, he said two words: smart voting. This is, of course, a reference to his strategy, which led to these losses by Kremlin-backed candidates, that this essentially was revenge for a scenario that they played out in Moscow with a numbers game that won them several races here locally. But Navalny's chief strategist, a guy named Leonid Volkov, noted that this is essentially stage one of this strategy at the rollout. And once they were getting ready to do smart voting efforts in regional races come 2020 and 2021, when we have Duma elections here for the parliament, that this eventually was almost guaranteed to somehow usurp power from the ruling United Russia Party and from pro-Kremlin candidates. So in a sense, this was a way to lash back at regional efforts to do that in the future.
You know, this is coming after, the Election Commission barred several opposition-oriented candidates from actually running. The elections took place. There are protests. What are people on the street, reacting to this? What are they saying?
Well, they're still trying to digest it. We just learned about this morning, so most of the information is, of course, being traded on social media, where we hear about from representatives in the region saying, that the police are at their door or breaking down their door. I was in touch personally with one of Navalny associates in Nizhny Novgorod. This is in the west of Russia, who said the police had first come to his mother's house. This is another kind of trend in police raids, that they came for not only the actual Navalny associates, but their families as well. So they were intimidating his mother, and he was waiting for the police to arrive at his apartment. So we've seen, a big diverse, and finally I should add that they've also been going to the actual, of course, Navalny offices and using those as well, where they've been taking computer equipment. They've also been cutting power to the offices in advance so that video monitoring systems can't record what happens inside. And so it seems really an effort to paralyze the organization completely.
Charles Maines reports for VOA in Moscow. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Arab citizens of Israel make up 20% of the population and could play a role in making up the government coalition. Linda Gradstein reports they have never joined a government in Israel's history, but some say It might be time for a change.
In the last Israeli election just 5 months ago, about half of Arab citizens of Israel voted. Their representation in the Israeli parliament, the Knesset, decreased from 13 members of Arab parties in 2015 to just 9. But a number of Arab parties are hoping to win more seats by teaming up as the joint list in the new election next week. Ahmed Tibi is number 2 on that joint list.
Our message as a joint list to our community, go and vote. Go and vote and have influence. This is your right, especially in the day of the election, in order to change our reality.
Knesset member Yusuf Jabarin says the Arab vote is crucial to stopping Benjamin Netanyahu from forming a narrow right-wing government and passing more laws he says discriminate against Arab citizens of Israel.
Going ahead with racist and discriminatory legislation that this government has been enacting in the last few years and will continue to do that if they will have the power to continue. So we definitely see that any seat, any additional seat that we gain in this election could really affect the makeup of the Knesset, and at least that could block Netanyahu from establishing an extreme right-wing government.
Netanyahu has repeatedly denied claims of discrimination against Arabs. He cites the growing number of Arab citizens at Israeli universities and their representation in the Knesset.
Israel has over 1 million Muslim citizens. They play a vital role in our society. They're judges, lawmakers, professors, prominent doctors, business people, much more.
The Arab parties have never been part of a government coalition together with majority Israeli parties. And joint list head Ayman Oda sparked controversy recently when he said that under certain conditions, maybe that should change. Opposition leader Benny Gantz, the head of the center-left Kahol Lavan party, said he was not interested. But some Arab citizens of Israel, like analyst Thabit Abu Ras, agreed with Oda.
I believe this statement is important to motivate and already motivating Arab voters. And also, it's opened the mind of some Jewish leaders. Here we are. We have a partner within the Arab community. And we will see, probably, more and more Jewish-Arab political cooperation in the future.
Arab citizens of Israel say their biggest issues are the rising crime rates where they live and policies they believe are discriminatory. The majority support a separate Palestinian state and fear that a Netanyahu win will destroy the possibility of ever creating such a state. But if the joint list wins enough seats, it can play a more important role in the next government. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
And this is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Researchers at the University of Nottingham, England, conducted a new study that suggests coffee could become an effective weapon in the battle against obesity. It turns out we actually have two kinds of fat, white or bad fat, the stuff we try to shed, and brown adipose tissue, also known as brown or good fat. Scientists say this good fat uses the bad fat, along with sugar, as fuel to burn calories and produce heat. Along with a number of other positive benefits, the heat produced by the brown fat also helps to keep us warm when it's cold. To make their findings, the researchers had their test subjects drink a cup of coffee. Soon after, they thermally imaged areas of the volunteers' bodies where the good fat is stored and found the coffee did help stimulate the brown fat to produce calorie and body fat burning heat. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The British government's plans for a no-deal Brexit warn of severe disruption to cross-channel routes affecting the supply of medicines and some fresh foods, and say that protests and counter-protests could take place across the country, accompanied by a possible rise in public disorder. Reuters' Mia Wormsley takes things from here.
The British government's worst-case Brexit scenarios makes for a bleak read. Potential panic buying and public disorder. A no-deal departure could mean severe disruption to cross-channel routes, problems for fuel, medical and fresh food supplies, and protests and counter-protests across the country. Operation Yellowhammer was published on Wednesday after a request from lawmakers. Prepared on August the 2nd, it says public and business readiness for a no-deal outcome would likely be low. The document states lorries could have to wait up to 2.5 days to cross the English Channel, and British citizens could face more immigration checks at EU border posts. Disruption could last a possible 3 months. Information sharing between police and security services would also be affected. Documents from Operation Yellowhammer first came to light in the Sunday Times newspaper on August the 18th. Michael Gove, minister in charge of no-deal preparations, said then that the document was not up to date. Despite handing the information over on Wednesday, he refused to do the same with advice from government advisers about suspending Parliament, saying it would be an inappropriate and disproportionate use of parliamentary procedure and the individuals would have no right to reply.
That was Reuters reporter Mia Wormersley. Now, the British government insists that the events in Operation Yellowhammer is an avoidable worst-case scenario. And as Prime Minister Boris Johnson denied also misleading the Queen about his reasons for suspending Parliament just weeks before the country is due to leave the European Union. Meanwhile, Brexit negotiator Michel Barnier in the EU says that they are still ready to work on a divorce deal with Britain.
Regarding the talks, we are still ready to examine objectively any concrete and legally operational proposal from the UK.
The comment comes a day after Britain's negotiator David Frost held talks with Barnier's team. Frost is expected to come back to Brussels for further talks on Friday. Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates are calling on Yemen separatists and the government to halt fighting in the south. The Gulf states back separate factions in the battle against Yemen's Houthi rebels. The UAE supports the Southern Transitional Council, and the Saudis support President Abdul Rab Mansour Hadi. They want the two groups to prepare for constructive dialogue to end a crisis between the two nominal allies. In August, the secessionist Southern Transitional Council took control of the southern city of Aden, the base of the Saudi-backed government since Houthis removed them from Sana'a in 2014. VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shanawi spoke with Nabil Al-Nawawi, a research associate at the Gulf International Forum in Washington, about the Arab allies' position and what is required to end the war in Yemen.
First of all, we need to differentiate between public statements of Saudi Arabia and the UAE and the realities. There are differences between Saudi Arabia and the UAE. The UAE supports separation of Yemen. They support STC, while Saudi Arabia thinks that Yemen should not be separated. They should have only one problem, one Yemen, not having Yemen two Yemens and therefore two problems. And I think that the differences between Saudi Arabia and the UAE are expanding, and it's crucial, regardless of the public statements and the joint statements by the two countries, there are differences, and where the UAE supports separation and Saudi Arabia does not.
What is required to end the war in Yemen?
I think we need, first of all, the Yemeni genuine interest in resolving this issue, but also, equally importantly, we need to have international pressure, and mainly the United States, to end this war. I think the United States can pressure Saudi Arabia, the leading country in this war, and some of the Yemeni parties to go to the negotiation table and make serious commitments to end the war. And I think this is maybe happening sometime soon, hopefully next year.
So what do you make of the United States' outreach to the Houthis, meeting them in Oman?
I think this is a very pragmatic step. Houthis, as we see it now, are the strongest Yemeni party in the ground, realistically. They control the north uncompetedly, while Hadi government and STC are competing over some portions of the south. So I think Houthis will be part of any government in the future. And I think the United States realizes this fact, and now they started to have some talks with the Houthis, as you said, in Oman. I think the first round was not very productive, but I think we'll be seeing more of those negotiations in the near future as well.
What kind of Yemen could emerge from the ruins of this war?
It is a very difficult question, and I think it's difficult for me to say exactly what will be Yemen after this war. I think that we maybe will have a federal system, a confederal system, considering that the U.S. is not very enthusiastic about the separation of Yemen. But also this might change as things develop in the country. But I think this should be left to the Yemenis. Maybe we'll see a referendum in the south, and we'll see if they would like to separate it from the north. And I think at this point, it's very difficult to say exactly how Yemen will be after the end of the war.
When the war started to defend the so-called legitimate government of Yemen, do you see a future role for Hadi's government in Yemen?
No, at all, actually. Actually, Hadi's government is a transitional. It was supposed to stay for 2 years, from 2012 to 2014, and it's up till now. Actually, it has no rule in Yemen right now. The Saudi-led coalition actually significantly weakened the Hadi government. And as we see now, they are based in Riyadh. They have nothing, no place in Yemen. So they will not have any future, especially Hadi in Yemen, but some of the parties under his government might be.
That was Nabil Al-Nawari, a research associate at the Washington-based Gulf International Forum. He was speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shanawi. A village outside the Philippine capital of Manila launched a program that will allow villagers to trade a kilogram of plastic waste for half its weight in rice in an attempt to motivate people to dispose of trash properly and clean up the streets in the process. Reuters' Jason Albano has that story.
In a village outside the Philippine capital of Manila, Veronica Dolorico roams the streets in search of plastic. She's known as the environmental auntie, collecting trash from her neighbors or simply picking it off the ground.
I feel that our surroundings is really dirty. If I only could, I would pick up all the plastics along the road whenever I walk outside. I'll bring my bag and pick up the garbage if that is possible.
In this village, bags of plastic are more than just waste. Every kilogram of plastic is worth half its weight in rice. For people living under the poverty line, a kilo of rice worth 70 cents can be a financial strain. For Dolorico, a mother of four and the wife of a rickshaw driver, the Plastics for Rice program is worth every grain.
14 kilos na.
It weighed in at 14 kilos of trash, so I got 7 kilos of rice grains. This is a big help for us to have 1 kilo of rice for the day.
The Philippines sits among the world's top marine plastic polluters, according to a joint report by Ocean Conservancy and McKinsey. The country's law on solid waste is poorly enforced and doesn't regulate packaging manufacturing. But the village program is a small step for the country. Village Captain Andor San Pedro says while the program won't help reduce plastic consumption, it can still teach people to properly dispose of waste.
Some people nowadays don't take initiative when there's no incentive. This is what we've thought to do so that they can have food.
San Pedro says that in August, over 213 kilos of plastic was collected and was given to the government for recycling. He also says that the win-win program is only generating more interest among families, a cheaper meal in exchange for cleaner streets.
Jason Albano brought us that story from Reuters. Controversy over where and when former Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe will be buried and a stampede which injured several people trying to view his body marred the mourning for the deceased leader on Thursday. A crowd insisting to see Mugabe's face in the partially opened casket surged past a police cordon, causing a crush in which several were injured at Rufaro Stadium in the capital's poor Mbare neighborhood where thousands had come to view his body. At least five people were carried away on stretchers, and the severity of their injuries was not immediately made clear. Others limped away or were treated by the Red Cross medics at the field. The dispute between Mugabe's family and the government has overshadowed arrangements for Zimbabweans to pay their respect. Mugabe will not be given a state burial on Sunday at the National Heroes Ark Center and will be buried at a place near his Blue Roof House. And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, engineer Sidrak Franklin, and managing editor, Kate Pound Dawson, thank you so much for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.